Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, the state is working to build a new nursing home for veterans.
There is a benefit out there that veterans have earned, and unless we have this facility, they cannot get that benefit. To me, that's the priority.
Kemmerer has an uncertain economic future. Its power plant could be closing, and town leaders are looking for ways to address the problem.
Hopefully there are solutions, but not three-year solutions. This town will just dry up and blow away.
Kids in Casper are using circles as a way to resolve conflict at their school, and they think adults should try it too.
And maybe one day it could be like used in American Congress or something.
Those stories in an interview with the head of Yellowstone National Park on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. A town in southwestern Wyoming is being forced to imagine life without coal at the center. Its power plant could close years earlier than expected, threatening hundreds of jobs. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports city leaders are racing to avoid becoming another ghost town.
Jim Bills stands under a carport at his white suburban home in Kemmerer. He's lived in town for the past 40 years, worked at the Kemmerer coal mine as a truck driver, laborer, and driller for 35, until he retired. The mine, along with the power plant it feeds, are central pieces of the local economy.
You know, a year ago, the town was going smooth. Same thing it's been doing for 100 years, a nice place to live, everybody's happy. We didn't see it coming.
What the town didn't see coming was that a large utility put its local power plant on a list of possible early closures. That's on top of the fact the local coal mine's owner, Westmoreland, filed for bankruptcy last year. It caused retirees like Bills to lose out on medical benefits. The news shook the town, says Mayor Tony Tomasi.
I thought, well, I'm seeing what it says, but this can't be real.
Tomasi's driving around Kemmerer, a neighboring Diamondville. He says the area was built by coal. We pass a cement wall with an engraved image of figures taking a pickaxe to coal, abandoned antique shops, and a park called Miners Memorial. Tomasi points out a recreation center that was built by energy companies.
Industry got together, built it, paid for it through a bond that they taxed themselves on.
In December, Rocky Mountain Power's owner PacifiCorp announced over half of its coal plants were more expensive to run than switching over to renewables or gas. No final decisions have been made about plant closures, but several scenarios have not been closing in 2022. Tomasi says early closure here would mean the loss of 126 jobs and others connected to it.
It's all the auxiliary industry that goes around with that.
Trucking companies, cement suppliers, electricians, and the largest, the Kemmerer coal mine, that employs more than 250 people. It relies on Naughton as its primary customer. If both the mine and plant went under, it would mean the loss of hundreds of jobs and the two largest taxpayers in the county.
Because if you take those jobs out of the town, and at this point, I don't know how you replace them.
He says all the uncertainty is hurting business. His car dealership isn't selling as much. You can see for sale signs on homes all over town. A local realtor says property values are declining. So in December, Tomasi and the other city leaders came together to discuss plans for a revitalized Kemmerer, plans that don't lean quite so heavily on coal. They hired a new city administrator, Brian Muir, to focus on just that. And he's been busy, with conferences, economic diversification meetings, summits. We had to meet at 9:30 p.m. in the dimly lit city council chambers.
Careful, strategic planning is really even more important for our community than it ever has been because of, we've been in the coal for decades.
Muir helped put together an action plan with an aggressive timeline. Its three main points: diversify the economy, increase manufacturing, and boost quality housing. He's looking at tourism opportunities, maybe attracting visitors interested in fossils. 50 million years ago, the area was full of tropical lakes. Robert Bowen owns a fossil shop in town. In the dusty back room of Wyoming Fossils, Bowen sifts through squares of stone with imprints of small fish, leaves, and even insects.
They're just no two the same.
He says quarries nearby have accessible fossils. The town could take advantage of that, market it more, gear vacation homes to it. for someone who might be interested in skiing in the winter and fossil hunting in the summer.
It's not a cure, but it will help. You know, every little bit we can do is going to help us.
Outside of town, Councilman Mark Quinn is excited about another opportunity. We're standing at the loadout station where the Kemmer mine prepares to send its coal elsewhere. He points into the open prairie. He imagines an industrial park on the 400-acre site out there.
We'd hope to see manufacturing facilities with those parts staged out here, laydown yards with the pipeline parts or various things, possibly silos that handle the materials.
Quinn imagines wind turbines could be made here, or even repaired, or possibly turn coal into a usable material. He says one of the town's biggest resources are its skilled workforce. That could be used here.
Hey, boo. Woo,
woo. Back at his home, Jim Bills, who retired from the coal mining company, says he loves living here. He's always known it as an energy town, though, and struggles to imagine something else, especially if the plant closes soon.
Hopefully there are solutions, but not three-year solutions. Not that it's going to happen in 3 years. This town will just dry up and blow away.
PacifiCorp will make its closure decision for the Naughton Power Plant on August 1st. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Buffalo is home to the state's assisted living facility for veterans. And during the past legislative session, lawmakers decided to provide some funding to build a new facility for veterans with a higher level of care. But the funding process is far from over. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports on how both facilities will serve a population in need.
The Veterans Home of Wyoming sits just a couple miles outside of the center of Buffalo. Its property is 960 acres at the base of the Bighorn Mountains, where Fort McKinney once stood. There's a fishing pond that's stocked every year with rainbow trout, and there's a small greenhouse not far from the main building where the residents grow different plants. Lisa Oswald heads the Aging Division at the Wyoming Department of Health and oversees the current veterans home. She says its mission is simple.
The responsibility is to care for those veterans who might need assistance with their daily living.
Oswald says it's similar to an assisted living home, and it currently serves veterans from age 25 to 92. Veterans come to live there when they might have medical and physical needs, and the home also provides mental health care and help with substance abuse. But it can't meet the needs of its residents who require more help, especially as they age, like those who lose their ability to complete daily tasks, like bathing. And the state says the facility could also help people who need things like a ventilator or have more severe mental health issues. Wyoming is the only state without a skilled nursing facility for veterans. But Executive Director of the Wyoming Veterans Commission, Steve Krivitsky, says that's not the most important reason the state needs the facility.
There is a benefit out there that veterans have earned, and unless we have this facility, they cannot get that benefit. To me, that's the priority, and taking care of our veterans.
Krivitsky is a veteran himself, a retired Air Force colonel. He says that the benefit is a per diem allowance provided by the federal government. It's money that can't be used at either of the federal VA hospitals in the state, which have certain disability requirements to qualify for benefits for higher levels of care.
Currently, it's about $109.63 a day that offsets their cost of care. And you don't have to be 70% service-connected disabled to get into that facility. You just need to be an honorably discharged veteran.
That's about $40,000 a year towards costs. On average, skilled nursing facilities range from $90,000 to $100,000 a year. So while the benefit doesn't cover everything, it definitely helps. Franz Fuchs is a policy analyst for the Wyoming Department of Health who has been working on the project. He says they plan to have 36 beds available, and the department has a plan to make sure the costs are affordable for veterans.
In theory, you could build this place and sort of just take the per diem and just subsidize the operation without really reducing those private pay rates. And our intent is really focusing on making sure those private pay rates are as low as possible so that financial benefit for long-term care is apparent and clear to the veterans who receive it.
The project is an ongoing team effort. The Wyoming Veterans Commission, the Wyoming Department of Health, and the State Construction Department have been working together to get a grant from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs that would provide 65% of the funding to build the facility. Krivitsky, with the Veterans Commission, says they are in the middle of the application process.
This whole process is a marathon. It's not a sprint, and we have not been approved by the VA yet to build this facility.
They started officially studying the issue in 2018 and narrowed potential locations to Sheridan, Buffalo, or Casper. Some of the biggest factors for the final choice were access to quality medical care, the number of veterans it could serve, and continuity with existing care. During the legislative session, there was debate on whether the facility should be located in Casper or Buffalo. Krivitsky says Buffalo was a good choice because of the continuity of care between facilities.
About 10% of the veteran population who currently resides in that assisted living facility is eligible for skilled nursing care. So now you're going to have a population of veterans who can transition on the same property to another level of care.
And Wyoming lawmakers did agree to pass legislation that would provide 35% of the funding for the project. Lisa Oswald with the Department of Health says a majority of the veterans at the facility now are estranged from their families, so their community at the home is important to them.
This is their family. And so when they have to get care somewhere else, then often they feel estranged then again from another family. And so really what is beneficial to the residents here is the camaraderie that they have with each other.
And in talking to veterans in Buffalo, they said they'd rather stay close to their friends. In May, the VA approved the first step of Wyoming's application for funding. The team has already sent in forms that prove the state is willing to match funding. Krivitsky says now they'll be working on building plans and other documents needed for the next step of the application.
Then the next phase, we have to do the level 3 study. And then once we're finished with that, we will meet our gate for the final application, and that is detailed drawings, environmental impacts, number of veterans, or it's just a host of things.
That study will continue through April of next year, and the final application will be due in June of 2020. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Buffalo.
When we come back, we'll bring you a couple of graduation stories. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. High school Native American students and their families have long-standing traditions of beading elements of their dress or wearing feathers on their tassels at graduation. This is to publicly honor the graduate in front of family and friends. But school districts in Wyoming don't have policies protecting their right to do that. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner reports.
Huda Curry Herrera plays basketball for Laramie High School. He's about to graduate and has a bright future ahead of him.
I know that's my way to college is through sports. With my mom supporting me like big throughout my whole high school career, like in sports, my whole family would show up like from the reservation. I'd have people come down every weekend or whenever we played, and they'd come and watch me. So I'd bring a good crowd to the home games here. So yeah.
He always figured they'd come down to see him graduate, too, and that he would be able to wear a beaded graduation cap and feather during the ceremony. Laramie doesn't have a policy against decorating caps, but stories from other Native students concerned Curry Herrera. Like Navajo and Shoshone Paiute member Alexis White Rock's story.
I asked the principal, I was like, well, it's kind of part of my culture and everybody on my family on my parents' reservation do. And I was really hoping if I could be my cap and put a feather on it, and they said no. And there was no way they were going to allow me to at all. And they said if I did, they would take my cap away from me.
White Rock graduated from Big Piney High School in 2016. She was told she could not bead her graduation cap because the privilege could also be abused. Kids could end up putting offensive or political imagery on their graduation caps instead. Stories like this worried Curry Herrera's mother, Renette Tendor, and his stepfather, Lee Tendor. The family was already trying to decide which skilled beader would embroider Huda's cap.
For me, on my side of the family, all of the ladies in my family are beaders. They all do the beadwork. It holds a high significance. The feather achievement, once you get a certain pinnacle in your life, a step higher, then he receives something, which is the feather.
And both Renette and Lee have many different tribal affiliations. Northern Arapaho, Eastern Shoshone, Pyramid Lake Paiute, Northern Ute. There is a lot to be proud of during Huda's graduation ceremony. Renette is the Native American Program Advisor at the University of Wyoming. She works to boost the University of Wyoming's poor Native enrollment numbers and is making a lot of progress. And with increasing enrollment, Native students will bring families to Laramie. So she went to the school board to help draft a new policy protecting graduation decorations.
And when we talked to the school board, we really talked to them about our UW Native initiatives that are going on campus to increase our Native enrollment, Native student enrollment here on campus. Numbers are rising here, and that I just encourage them to be mindful that their numbers are also going to rise.
Jubal Yenny is the superintendent of school district number one and has been supportive through the policy drafting process.
I think from our standpoint, this reflects our community. And Laramie has an opportunity that a lot of places in Wyoming do not have, just because we're not terribly diverse. But for the most part, we try to recognize that we've got different cultures here, and we want to be able to celebrate those.
And while the issue is being tackled in Laramie, House Representative Andy Clifford wants to draft legislation that protects beadwork at high school graduations all over the state.
I want to put it in state statute because we do have Native Americans living across Wyoming in different towns. It's just highlighting the indigenous people of this country and in a way honoring us. And it's nothing political. It's just embracing the diversity of indigenous people.
The policy to protect beadwork at graduation in Albany County should be in place by the end of the summer. In the meantime, Hutto was allowed to wear his beaded cap and feather during graduation. Looking down from the stands at the graduating seniors, it was easy to spot Hutto with his dangling feather, a symbol of strength and honor. For Wyoming Public Media, I'm Taylor Stackner.
It is high school graduation season. At Laramie High School each year, students select a teacher to give a keynote address. They're expected to share wisdom and advice for the future. This year's speaker really made a lasting impression. Wyoming Public Radio's David Graff has more.
It's the morning of Laramie High School's graduation, and the energy in the University of Wyoming Arena Auditorium is lacking. History and social studies teacher Will Plum is trying to pump up the students gathered for graduation practice. He's running back and forth across the stage, conducting the kids in the wave. Plum was selected by the 2019 class to give this year's commencement speech at graduation. Plum says he thinks it's the connection that he made with kids through clubs and activities outside of the classroom that made him their top choice. Graduate Dorian Ackerson echoes that sentiment.
A lot of our class knew him outside of school and from other things out there, so when we finally got to him in school, it was really meaningful for us.
The big question on the minds of the students is what Mr. Plum will say. Graduate Everett Chai has one idea.
I assume he'll be like, Everett, I hated you in my class, and I don't like you at all.
Plum says he's going to take a different approach.
My last speech was fun, but a little incoherent. And I wanted the kids to have something they could take with them. And so my thought was, man, maybe I'm not super good at speeches like this, but what can I do that I can send them away with? And I'm like, oh, I'll write them a song.
Plum plays in several bands, and he is mainly a drummer. He does write his own music, but he describes the music he writes personally as a kind of dark alt country.
So the extra challenge was, can I write something that's authentic?
Graduation kicks off with the usual pomp and circumstance. About an hour in, Mr. Plum is invited to the stage. The graduates cheer on Mr. Plum, but they still have no idea what's coming. Plum's song is titled the start and tells the kids that he's been in their shoes before. He knows how long they have been waiting for this moment. He warns the kids that the world will change on them, but they shouldn't worry. This is only their beginning, and they can't be counted out. When the graduates fully realize that what's happening is a musical performance and not a speech, they rise out of their seats and start waving their cell phone lights in the air, like they're at a concert. When the song ends, Plum takes a bow as the crowd delivers him a raucous round of applause. Once the ceremony ends, graduate Cooper Zane Jackson says he was thrilled by the song.
It was a complete surprise, and I don't think anyone expected him to do a song as his speech. So it was a lot more than any of us expected or hoped for.
Others say that Plum's performance was just Mr. Plum being Mr. Plum. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm David Graff.
Will Plum professionally recorded his song. You can hear it by visiting wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Coming up, we'll learn about an interesting way young students can express themselves and a visit with the superintendent of Grand Teton National Park. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. According to the Centers for Disease Control, students who feel connected to their teachers and peers are more likely to succeed in school and stay out of trouble. To give students a sense of power and stability, a school in Casper is using circles. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson was invited to participate in one. She brings us this audio postcard.
The Woods Learning Center is a squat brick building that looks like your typical school, but there's something unique happening within these walls.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
A group of 6th, 7th, and 8th graders have pushed the tables and desks aside in a classroom and have arranged the chairs in a big circle.
Where do I go?
Wherever you wish.
I find my spot amongst the 20 or so students. They're quiet and still, not your typical middle school crowd. A talking piece is passed around the circle. Whoever has it speaks while everyone else listens. The students leading this morning's circle have asked us to use colors to describe our current mood.
I'd have to choose white because it's more of like a neutral color because I'm kind of stressed out from my main life and then for school, yeah.
If my mood were a color, it would be a rainbow with a cat and a llama holding hands sliding down it.
Probably be like an umber because it's mellow and that's how I'm feeling.
The feelings are all over the place, stressed, silly, mellow, and grieving for the loss of a family member.
Blue or bright yellow, because my great-grandpa just passed away, but he was happy that he lived a long life, so that makes me happy.
After moods, students are invited to share who inspires them and what brings them joy, and then they're asked to consider the difference between how people perceive them and how they perceive themselves. Because what they say is personal, circles are usually confidential, but they've made an exception for my visit. And it doesn't seem to stop anyone from opening up.
I think a lot of people think of me as the girl that's happy mostly all the time and super confident and not afraid to speak out, but every day I'm just like, help. I am so scared. I'm so nervous. I just don't like to let it show.
And for those who can't figure out how they feel, well, that's welcome too.
Can you come back to me, please?
Marcy Mills, who teaches 4th and 5th grade, says circles build a culture of empathy.
And I think it gives them the ability to accept each other a little bit more, to know we're not all the same. We don't all come from the same place. And so if somebody is coming from a rough situation, they might not be as ready to learn coming in the door. And so they're more gracious.
Mills and teacher Jenny Marshall brought circles to their classrooms several years ago. And this year, for the first time, Woods Learning Center, which is grades K through 8, is using the practice school-wide. Marshall, who teaches in the middle school, says circles have shifted her approach to behavior management.
Teachers know there's reasons behind behaviors a lot, but I mean, it's easy to get into kind of the cycle of the day and just, okay, you're misbehaving, just stop, knock it off. You know, like, I'm not going to think about what is making this happen.
Marshall says what she learns about kids during circles helps her to get at the root of why they might be acting out. It gives her a chance to help a kid solve a problem rather than just doling out a punishment. A sixth grader named Presley says circles make her feel safe.
If people listen to you, you feel validated, and that leads to you feeling happy and secure, like you can trust people.
And research indicates that a sense of security is key to learning. When kids feel insecure, the brain goes into fight or flight mode, and that can override the capacity to process new information. Circles also help kids resolve conflict, like Sam, who's in sixth grade.
It's happened to me a little bit. There are just some people that kind of get on me, and I kind of learn what they're going through circles, and then I can better understand them and work with them.
Teacher Jenny Marshall says in the beginning, those resolutions were harder to come by, but now
they can sit down and take the harm, what's been done, kind of separate it from the person, which is incredible because that's something I, as an adult, still struggle with and see people struggle with. So they're able to talk about the problem and not the person.
She admits that it doesn't work for all kids, and so the school still uses traditional discipline measures like suspension. But most of the kids I talk to would rather solve problems with circles. Presley thinks circles even have the power to change the world.
There would be less people that are quick to judge because they know the story behind the person. And maybe one day it could be like used in American Congress or something, because people can listen to each other and hear those sides of the story that they might not hear with the current techniques now.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
With over 6 months under his belt, Yellowstone National Park Superintendent Cam Shawley has released the park's top five strategic priorities. Those include investing in infrastructure, focusing on the people who work at the park, and how to deal with increased visitation. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska spoke with Shawley about two priorities that impact our region, starting with the need to strengthen the ecosystem.
It is an ecosystem that is under threat. It can be under threat from climate change, could be under threat from increased visitation. So we can't be complacent and, you know, taking the condition of the Yellowstone ecosystem now and just hoping that it'll stay in that condition in the future. And so there's a lot of proactive measures that we need to continue to focus on from, this, like I said, in the priorities, you know, understanding and responding effectively to climate change. How do we continue to promote larger landscape conservation from a wildlife perspective, not only within Yellowstone, but beyond Yellowstone boundaries? How do we continue to work with states, for instance, on wildlife corridors and cooperative conservation efforts? And then we have some of the most incredible historic and cultural resources in the world in Yellowstone, and we need to do a much better job of caring for those core cultural resources, whether those are, you know, the sites that we protect or the structures that we need to improve. A lot of work needs to be done across that spectrum. And so, you know, I look at what's happened at Lake Yellowstone as both a success and a failure. A success from the standpoint that we actually, because of incredible efforts, the cutthroats are rebounding, and we're continuing a very positive trend in eradicating lake trout, a non-native species. That said, how did we get into that situation in the first place? And that's where we kind of failed. And there's some good lessons learned there. most importantly, how do we take those lessons and make sure that we're looking for the right indicators across the ecosystem where there's native species that are under threat potentially? Do we pick up those warning signs early on and take the right action early? And that's really important. And our prioritization system and structure we work within has got to be designed in a way that's conducive for detecting those types of things early on, so we're not responding like we are at Lake Yellowstone and putting $2.2 million into saving a species that we almost let blink out.
Second priority that I wanted to chat a little bit about is the build coalitions and partnerships. So how is the park going to continue grow partnerships with gateway communities like CODI?
Well, once again, there's so many partners. It's a matter of us being organized and understanding how to continue to build relationships. And so many things that occur in the park affect gateway communities and states and other private landowners and other entities outside the park and vice versa. And so only through kind of an organized dialogue and ensuring that we've got an approach that helps us understand what, say, CODI's concerns are. And CODI's concerns, you know, there may be some commonality between what CODI wants to talk about and, say, West Yellowstone, but there are differences also. And so do we understand when we have those conversations, number one, do we have the right relationships built with the right people? And that's essential. And are those conversations ongoing so that we have a trust that builds over time and an ability to pick up the phone and call each other or work through problems? And whether that's with a gateway community or a business owner or a tribe or an elected official or a landowner for that matter, it's really important for us with so many different people interested in what we're doing in Yellowstone to have an organized approach to that. And I think the other part of partnerships, it's not just external. And Yellowstone's a really big park. We've got incredible partners in the park, like our concessioners, like Vanterra and Delaware North, Yellowstone Park Service Stations. How are we partnering with them? How are we working within the Park Service team and partnering across divisional boundaries for maximum efficiency and those types of things? And so, you know, it's building coalitions and partnerships is core to our mission. It's needed. It's something that we can't succeed without great partnerships. But this is a matter of us really focusing on how do we get organized and how do we have the right dialogue with the right partners on the right topics and let that dialogue build into action.
Is there anything else that you kind of wanted to highlight that I didn't ask?
The only thing I would say that would be good is we're going to continue to, we're working a five-year plan on improving employee housing, getting rid of 75 obsolete trailers. You know, some of the conditions some of these employees are living in are unacceptable to me. We've got a good plan coming together that will both improve existing housing and replace housing where necessary, and there's more to come on that.
If you visit Old Faithful, the Grand Tetons, or the Grand Canyon these days, you're bound to find dozens of people taking selfies on their smartphones. From our Mountain West News Bureau, Nate Hedgie tells us how this phenomenon is changing our connection with the outdoors.
It's 5:30 in the morning at Canyonlands National Park in southern Utah. The pre-dawn sky is just beginning to show color, and Jonathan Zank's frantically setting up his camera.
I plan to shoot a time-lapse of the entire sunrise.
And not just any sunrise, but the sun rising over deep canyons and rock spires, all framed by a glowing orange arch.
Once the sun comes up, the color of the arch is really incredible.
Zhang says it's a stunning view, one you've probably seen before. A few years ago, Microsoft used a picture of the sunrise at Mesa Arch as one of its backgrounds for Windows 7. The landmark has since blown up on social media, making this once hidden gem at Canyonlands Instagram famous. Zhang remembers coming here a decade ago.
There were only maybe two or three guys, but now, you know, it's like every morning is crowded.
Today, dozens of photographers and tourists with their smartphones are all huddled near Zhang, trying to get the same shot. There's an Italian man with long brown hair sitting next to a big camera rig. A bearded college kid is FaceTiming the sunrise for his buddy. Hiker Liesl Alexander has just arrived to Mesa Arch, and she looks dumbfounded. I mean, she was prepared for a crowd, but...
That was a surprise. I was expecting this many people, but not this many people all up in there. You can't even see what's going on.
We watch as a couple of tourists pose for selfies near the edge of a cliff before a nearby photographer waves them away. And that points to another ramification of all these selfies. People sometimes do stupid things to get them. They climb arches, step onto geysers, or stand right next to a bison at Yellowstone. Park officials there have even implemented a so-called safe selfie pledge. No one's fallen off the steep cliff near Mesa Arch yet, but it's definitely becoming more popular with the selfie-taking crowd. Alexander's hiking buddy, Renee Gardner, says that growing popularity is a double-edged sword.
You know, the parks need money and contributions, but it's also when you come to, like, view something like this and there's a million people taking pictures and you can't really enjoy the view.
But is social media to blame for these big crowds? It's true. People sometimes tag their exact location when they share these photos. But Ashley D'Antonio says we shouldn't rush to judgment just yet. She's a recreation ecologist at Oregon State University.
There hasn't been a study done yet that's been published that's been able to show a direct cause and effect.
She says low gas prices and a good economy may be more to blame than social media. And anyway, she argues sharing locations on Instagram and Facebook can actually be a good thing because it leads to more diversity.
So most of the visitors to our parks and protected areas are kind of upper middle class, white, slightly older. But there's been a lot of groups that use social media to kind of get more people of color or people that aren't traditionally seen in our protected areas out recreating and promoting that, you know, this is a space for you too.
Still, bigger crowds are leading to tensions between smartphone-wielding tourists and serious photographers who used to have these spaces more to themselves. Photographer Drew Armstrong and a couple of his buddies watch as a young woman strikes a yoga pose in front of the arch.
It's frustrating when they want to get a shot in their Lululemon pants. Because they're wearing Lululemon pants, I wanted them to be here and say, you know what, this is important. This needs to be protected.
Armstrong and his two friends believe that in the rush to take selfies and post them to the internet, people are missing out on what makes the parks and public lands so amazing in the first place.
Solitude, peaceful moments, nature.
That's Armstrong's buddy, Neil Zingle. And it's so crowded here that I can barely hear him.
We're so focused on saying that we were there or so focused on having that information that people think you can capture in a snapshot. You can't do that. You have to take the time. It's sort of an old-fashioned approach, but you got to take the time to experience it. There's no shortcutting it. It's hard to watch.
But as the sun rises above Mesa Arch, the big crowds full of photographers and tourists begin to dwindle. The Instagram moment is over, and eventually no one is left. It's just a big blue sky, some deep cracked canyons, and the mid-morning sun baking an open red rock desert. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Canyonlands National Park.
We will wrap up the program with the anniversary of the Cody Stampede. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. For the few days on and around July 4th, Cody hosts a parade and rodeo known as the Cody Stampede. This year marks the 100-year anniversary of the rodeo. In its history, it's attracted the local community, professional rodeo riders and ropers, tourists, and even Hollywood stars. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska takes us back to the Stampede's founding, and why it still holds a special place in the hearts of Cody residents.
Jerry Gillette has been around the Cody Stampede her whole life.
I grew up on a ranch, and we've always been around horses. It was a big deal to come to the Stampede, like a big deal.
Every year, hundreds of spectators fill the Cody Stampede area to see over 800 of some of the best professional rodeo riders and ropers compete for a prize of $400,000. Advertisements in the local paper encourage the town to dress up for the part. Wear your cowboy boots and Stetson hat. Locals happily comply. But for Gillette, the stampede is even more personal. Her son, Nick, was killed at another rodeo riding Saddle Bronx 9 years ago.
When I lost my son, we had the funeral out there, and they turned the bucking horses loose, and there was like 5,000 some people out there, and it's very special to me. I'd just like to give back to the community.
For 100 years, the stampede has brought people like Gillette together to create something for Cody. It all starts back in 1913 when the Prince of Monaco was visiting Cody. The town transformed the county fair to an event that was meant to share the culture of the West. That's according to Jeremy Johnson, the curator of the Buffalo Bill Museum.
Buffalo Bill brought in Johnny Baker and some performers from Buffalo Bill's Wild West, and they changed the Park County Fair into almost a Wild West show / rodeo.
Johnson says Cody was at the time really a farming town, but with the influence of Buffalo Bill, the community started to strongly identify with the myth of the West.
So as time developed, eventually Cody became more and more focused on rodeo. And the beginning of the Cody Stampede really starts in 1919 when Clarence Williams decides to organize a rodeo for the opening of the park, something that would entertain visitors who were traveling through Cody, Wyoming to Yellowstone.
Mary Robinson is the director of the McCracken Research Library. She says in the early days, the rodeo was more diverse than it is now.
And the pattern was set by Buffalo Bill's Wild West, if you think about it, because Buffalo Bill's Wild West first brought bucking horses into an arena and made them a spectacle. But they also brought women.
Women competed in all sorts of competitions, and there were events that don't exist anymore today and were pretty popular, says Robinson, like the Roman standing race.
The rider actually stood with one foot on each of two horses that were galloping along a racetrack, and it was a race.
But as rodeos became more and more popular nationally, Robinson says standards were imposed as rodeos organized.
And they had to do that in order to fight back against unscrupulous managers who would run rodeos and then not pay out.
But even though the events became more standardized, the allure of an adrenaline rush still attracts spectators and aspiring riders and ropers. And so the Cody Stampede has continued to grow. Jerry Gillette and her son are a part of that legacy. And this past year, she became the first woman to be on the Cody Stampede board since Caroline Lockhart, who served as the first director of the board 100 years ago. Gillette says the community has always been there for her and all the locals. She says ultimately, the Cody Stampede is an important staple to creating a supportive, friendly place to live.
I see so many young kids that put their life into rodeo instead of drinking, drugs, blah, blah, blah. And I think that's very important. I mean, to me, it is, just because I grew up on a farm ranch.
And Gillette is just one of many. For the month of June, the town is gearing up to celebrate and inform visitors why the Stampede is so special to them. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kodalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
The Center of the West is commemorating the 100-year anniversary of the Stampede with a special exhibition that opens June 7th.
The Cheyenne Board of Public Utilities is featuring a new way to conserve water and promote pollinators. Dina Eakenhoff is the board's water conservation specialist, and she tells us that they've created a Habitat Hero Garden featuring flowers, drought-resistant plants, and grasses to teach people how they can create beautiful yards while saving water. She tells me about their effort.
The Board of Public Utilities is really concerned about how much water that we have now and into the future. Sometimes we fill our reservoirs and sometimes we don't. About 23% of the time, we don't fill our reservoirs. And sometimes we have really wet years, like this year. In other years, it's a very dry out, or we have droughts. And so one way we can conserve water and avoid expenses about finding and developing new water sources is conserving water. And one way to conserve water is taking your traditional turf or lawn and converting it into a habitat that has drought or native plants on it that can significantly reduce your water use.
So tell me about what you've done there.
So what we're doing essentially is making sure that people are bee smart, water smart. That is converting their lawns and landscapes and turning it into a friendly atmosphere for bees, butterflies, and birds that need food, water, and shelter. So at the board, we've removed 1,500 square feet of turf, traditional lawn, and instead we put in about 400 water smart plants. And we also put in 1,275 bulbs. So we've created this beautiful habitat full of beautiful colors from spring all the way into fall that are great for those that need those food and also shelter.
There's a lot of people probably listening. I might even be one of those people that wonder how hard this is, and maybe it's just as easy to keep the lawn there. How much of a challenge is this for somebody to do on their own?
You know what? I'm all about DIY, and I've been doing this at my own home for a long time now. So I just kind of take it at small chunks at a time. So I kind of prepare ahead of time, and I get some cardboard, and during the winter time, I put the cardboard down, and I kill my grass that way. I don't have to put any chemicals on it. I just kill it with my cardboard. You know, reduce the amount of sunlight, and you're good to go. And then I'll do some winter sowing or winter seed sowing. So I just put in some milk jugs and I put some seeds in there and I let them grow all winter long, stick them outside in these milk jugs. And by springtime, I have some beautiful plants that I can put in at a really low cost. And so I get rid of the grass. I put in these beautiful plants, and within about a year, I have flowers, and it's just amazing transformation. I have my own sanctuary in my backyard, and I also have noticed, too, the neighborhood effect. So I've done this in my neighborhood, and my neighbors said, wow, this looks wonderful, and it's great, and they started doing the exact same thing that I did. So it's a little bit of neighborhood envy / competition that motivates some people. But you don't have to go big. You can start small and just keep expanding as you can.
What types of savings might a traditional person see if they could take this route?
If you take the route of converting your traditional turf into something that's water smart, you can save anywhere between 18 to 50% on your water bill. And that's for your outdoor irrigation. So that is, to me, a very substantial cut in the amount of water that you can use. The things that are native that are around here, whether it's buffalo grass or whether it's those nice native flowers that you see when you go on for a nature hike, those are the type of plants that are used to these dry climates of 15 inches of precipitation a year. And it's the best thing that you can do, I think, for your whole entire landscape.
And then one last thing, what you've seen both at the city and at home, you've seen an abundance of bees and butterflies, that kind of thing?
Yes, we were really surprised. We put our demonstration garden in on June 2nd, and it was in September. We actually had the monarch butterflies come and visit in droves. And so we had all these butterflies in our garden feasting on these beautiful pink asters. And so it's an amazing experience, and also it really helps us all out in the long run. Because one out of three bites of food are there because of pollinators like bees, birds, and butterflies. So, if we want to continue to eat, like I would like to continue to eat, we really need to support those pollinators.
Dina Egenhoff is the Water Conservation Specialist for the Cheyenne Board of Public Utilities.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. This show and individual segments are available on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. You can never miss an episode if you sign up for our podcast on that website or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
You can support Open Spaces and all of our Wyoming news coverage with your pledge of support. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.